Can a deep knowledge of business cycle theory make you money? How about Austrian price theory or knowledge theory? Rick Rule studied them all, mastered them all, and earned both significant market rewards and a position of entrepreneurial leadership in his field.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hey, Hunter Hastings here. At Economics for Entrepreneurs, our mission is to help entrepreneurs and their businesses succeed. We aim to achieve our goal by helping you apply the laws of economics to business in the context of a deep understanding of customers and their wants, needs, preferences, and values. Entrepreneurial businesses are, at their core, customer first. Their mission and their goals are to create customers, satisfied, delighted, repeat customers who ideally will recommend the entrepreneur's services to their friends and acquaintances and colleagues. This requires a multi-stage process in which every step requires empathy and understanding on the part of the entrepreneur. First, the entrepreneur chooses whom to serve. Whom do they know who might need a new service to solve a problem they have, or relieve a dissatisfaction, or erase an uneasiness, or improve an imperfect experience? How well does the entrepreneur know the customer? Depth of understanding is needed to be able to fit into their complex, multi-layered, interconnected lives in a way that's convenient and efficient for them. Listening with the heart, as Isabella Naber taught us in our October 1, 2019 episode, is a required entrepreneurial skill to develop a true empathic understanding of customers. Understanding translates into design. Designing a service or a solution that fits, meets the customer's need, solves their problem, and relieves their unease. We can observe a very personal relationship that's developing. Modern businesses create instant, intimate, perfect fit experiences that delight customers. And customers always get the final verdict. They can buy or not buy. They can return or not return. They can repeat or not repeat. They can compare lots of alternative offers. They can complain or make a request with a high expectation of getting attention and response. They can often demand personalization and special terms. The entrepreneur is an angel, dedicated to listening to what people want and delivering it to them. So, how does dynamic entrepreneurial capitalism, the institution that incorporates all the behavior I just described, get a reputation and image of exploitation and dishonesty? How are people convinced that entrepreneurs are out to fool them or make lopsided bargains in their own favor or fail to deliver? Why does entrepreneurial business have a reputation that is less than the stellar one that would be appropriate for the kind of behavior we've just described? One reason is education. The reputation of entrepreneurial capitalism may be damaged in school by educational malpractice before young people are able to form a realistic opinion in the marketplace. Another might be media hostility from journalists who don't understand entrepreneurship or hold an antipathy towards it. Whatever the cause, it's important to the future of civilization that has so dramatically improved living standards, longevity, health, and well-being that new generations develop the right understanding of entrepreneurial dynamics. Today, our guest is Rick Rule, CEO of Sprott US Holdings, Inc. Rick is the world's leading financial expert specializing in mining, energy, water utilities, forest products, and agriculture. His company has built a national reputation on taking advantage of global opportunities in the oil and gas, mining, alternative energy, agriculture, forestry, and water industries. Rick is a frequent speaker at conferences, prolific writer, and can be found on YouTube by searching his name. Rick, hello.
Nice to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us at Economics for Entrepreneurs, Rick. You're a hero for us. You're a successful and accomplished lifetime entrepreneur, and we look forward to learning from you. And specifically, a quick search of Rick Rule on YouTube reveals some videos, one of which I enjoyed particularly, where you said, you love what you do, you loved it from the start, you love your job every day, and we're hoping to pick up some of that as well.
Well, it's all true. I do love what I do. I love my customers. I can't wait to get to work in the morning. If you define work the way some people do as an unpleasant way to make a living, I've never worked a day in my life.
I know one of the things I hate about Austrian economics is this idea of disutility of labor, the economics people call it, which is you hate your job, which is the opposite of what you and I think. So we'll fix that. I thought we'd start with your field, Rick, because you said you identified natural resources finance very early on. And it sounded from the context like that was at school and college. So please tell us about that. How did you find that preference? How did that start in your mind? How did the journey begin?
Well, ironically, as a teenager, I was drawn to those types of things because I like the outdoors. The consequence of my profession is that I sit in an office all the time and never get outdoors, but that's a different story.
Irony.
I was interested in natural resources and, in a broader sense, science related to land and land use, agriculture, geology, stuff like that from a very young age. And I was also attracted to finance. And so the obvious intersection of that was natural resource finance. For that reason, and other reasons, not least of which was the war in Vietnam, as a young man, I emigrated to Canada and attended the University of British Columbia, which had a reasonable commerce faculty but was outstanding in some of the scientific disciplines related to earth sciences and natural resources, and really never looked back.
That's a great indication of one of the principles that we talk about, which is if you can combine different fields of knowledge, in your case, the outdoors and land, and then finance, you can often come up with something that is pretty new and innovative and full of opportunity. So it sounds like you did that.
I was very lucky. I have to give some credit to President Kennedy, President Johnson, and President Nixon, the impetus of the war in Vietnam that caused me to change my life and go to Canada and get out of their way. They were helpful too.
Yeah, it's not what happens in the outside world. It's how you react to it. So that became an entry into business. It became an area of knowledge specialization for you, Rick, and then I've read that you specialize in privately placed debt and equity issuances for resource companies. So that's an area of technical expertise. Again, tell us how you combined those fields of knowledge to develop your early business.
Well, one of the things, I guess two things became apparent to me fairly early on. The first was that resource businesses were, even more than other businesses, extremely cyclical, extremely volatile, and extremely capital intensive, which meant that you had to have the psychological and financial ability to be aggressive during bad times when it wasn't immediately profitable, and it was also psychologically taxing. The second thing I learned about was that throughout finance, not just in natural resources, but rather throughout finance, that information wasn't really ubiquitously or evenly distributed. Information was often distributed by brokerage firms, sell-side people, and a lot of the information that they distributed was self-interested. And also, that while information was reasonably available about the largest companies in the natural resources business, the great big mining houses like BHP or the big oil and gas places like Exxon, if you looked at market capitalizations below $1 billion and particularly below $250 million, that information wasn't very well distributed at all. And what began to happen over time is that my interest and hence my practice began to favor smaller companies that were in need of capital during periods of time when capital was not otherwise available. In other words, I began to become the capital provider of last resort to deserving companies, to very high quality teams, in small cap issuers in unpopular sectors. And when the sectors that I was involved in returned to favor, as they ultimately do in a cyclical business, I was rewarded quite extravagantly. And that's been what I do for a living ever since.
Let's just focus on a couple of those lessons, Rick. One is time preference. You talked about times when you're not going to be rewarded, but if you invest at that time, you see rewards in the future. Is that something you can learn? Was it a personal capability, do you think? Was it just a strategic assessment? How did you make that choice?
Oh, I learned it a very hard way. In the decade of the 70s, which is when I came into the resource business, we were in a tremendous natural resource bull market. And I made the mistake that many young men made. I confused a bull market with brains. And thought I was very, very smart. And come 1982, when that market collapsed, I learned just how smart I was, which is to say, not very. And it was at that moment that I learned how cyclical natural resource-based businesses are. The truth is that when commodity prices are very high, everybody wants to be in them. But when prices are high, you increase supply and you restrict demand. I mean, this is classic human action. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, prices collapse. But I was smart enough to figure out that the inverse is true as well. The cure one learns for high prices is high prices. And the cure for low prices are low prices. Now, most people, I think, regard themselves as rational fact checkers. They think of themselves as gathering inputs wherever they can, processing those inputs rationally, and using that information to make fact-based decisions. But that's not true. People search the universe for information that supports their existing preferences and paradigms, meaning that they aren't actually fact seekers at all, but rather paradigm reinforcers.
Yeah.
And you need to try and work through that. The second thing is recency bias, as you described. People's experience in the immediate past is what is most important in shaping their opinion of the future. Ironically, you go through periods of time in resource industries where the fully loaded cost of producing a product is higher than the selling price of the product, which is to say that the industry as a whole mm-hmm. is unprofitable, in liquidation, and hence out of favor. But if you think about it logically, at periods of time like that, there are two possible outcomes. One, the price of the commodity can increase, or two, the commodity can become unavailable. If the commodity, like, say, copper or oil, is essential for our way of living, it is highly unlikely that the commodity becomes unavailable, and much more likely, certain from my point of view, that the price goes up. Having the courage to endure that period of uncertainty where you don't know when the price will go up is key to investing in cyclical businesses.
We are listening to Rick's remarkable entrepreneurial journey. And I'd like to point listeners to our system for building such a path for yourself. It's all in our online course, An Austrian Entrepreneur's Journey. You'll start with self-assessment and effectual entrepreneurship resources. You'll consider the choices of whom to serve, as Rick did. You'll design your innovation and define its relevance and differentiation, and learn how to build a brand. There are resources and tools for you at every stage. Check it out online at e4epod.com/journey. That's the letter E, the number 4, letter E, pod.com/journey. Now, back to our conversation. So we're always talking in economics, Rick, about uncertainty and that the entrepreneur bears uncertainty. So what I hear saying is a certain personal way of doing that, and that's courage. Is that right?
Yeah, courage, and I suspect just experience. You know, certainly courage in the sense that I'm very, very willing by now to be lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And also in the more speculative parts of my portfolio, in the part of my investments that involve exploration with an uncertain outcome, I'm willing to tolerate loss. I understand in the speculative part of my portfolios that the expectation on each individual speculative decision is a loss, but the arithmetic is that the gains that I will enjoy from my successful efforts will more than amortize the losses that I suffer in my unsuccessful efforts. Many people don't have the psychological strength to suffer speculative losses that they otherwise financially could afford. I do have that ability, and hence speculation is something that's paid off very well for me as well.
Was any part of this a learning curve, Rick? You talk about experience as the great teacher. Or did you feel those attributes from the beginning?
Oh no, I had to experience all of them painfully. Yes, certainly I had to experience all of them painfully. I looked at the money that could be made in exploration, and ironically, my first couple of exploration efforts were successful, which is probably the worst thing that can happen to a young speculator. Again, I became overconfident. But over time, I learned that the expectation in that type of speculation is failure. And so one has to have a reasonable number of well-considered starts so that one's successes can amortize one's failures.
So you're on LinkedIn, your business is, the business that you started was Global Resource Investment. Was that your first business or straight out of college?
No, I've been a serial entrepreneur. In fact, I put myself through university first by working in, but then owning bars and restaurants. So my initial entrepreneurial venture was really a series of mistakes that culminated in me being pretty successful in the hospitality business. Unfortunately, I didn't like it. I was there simply because I needed and wanted to make some money. And as soon as I'd made enough money to do something else, I exited that business where I knew ultimately I wouldn't be a big success simply because I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, that's another good principle. Do what you love. So you, when you had got to that point, you started Global Resource Investments, and then you ran that for how long?
I started Global Resource Investments, if my memory serves me well, in 1990. Having worked for a variety of other employers, both being self-employed and also as an agent for 10 years. In 2011, I sold Global Resource Investments to a competitor, Sprott Inc. It was an odd circumstance. I found myself at Global Resource Investments. The business had grown a lot, and I found myself doing something that I thought was dishonest. I was spending more than half my time running a business while my customers were hiring me to run their money.
Yeah.
And I decided really that I would sell the business to a larger firm that could focus on running the business while I went back to the business that I enjoyed, which was, in fact, finance and investments.
Yeah, creating value for others.
Correct.
Yeah. But now you're president and CEO of Sprott US Holdings. So is that a further advance?
No, not really. That's really a title. Sprott is flat enough that the real job description is do what needs to be done when it needs to be done. The truth is that I have been mercifully removed from many administrative functions. And the title CEO is really three letters on a business card, I guess designed to give me some form of gravitas.
Well, actually, we've been talking here a lot about separating administrative tasks from value creation tasks. So it sounds like that's what you've done. But there are certain administrative tasks that are necessary. I mean, compliance is one in your industry, I imagine, and HR and things like that. So maybe you found a good secret to separate the value creation from the administration. Is that?
Well, there are different ways that different personalities can create value. And there's nothing to say that, as an example, a CEO wouldn't be someone who adds value as an organizer or an administrator. The way I add value, I think, is as an investor, as an analyst, and as a speculator. And I certainly employ my analytical skills in terms of analyzing and trying to improve my own business. But the part of that that has to do with organization and administration is something that we have very good people around to do. I don't happen to be one of them.
But you've created an organization that makes that specialization possible and effective.
Yeah, we have done
that,
yes.
Any advice there, any secrets for mid-sized businesses or even larger businesses that are trying to do that?
Well, I think, you know, I think good advice for all entrepreneurs is to understand when you are your roadblock, when you are your impediment to success. At Global, I reached a point, as I say, where my ability to add value was constrained by running the organization that I was attempting to add value to. Having the ability to realize that there is a time when a founder must step aside, or at least should step aside, for the benefit of his or her customers is, I think, a very important lesson. There are certainly people who have broader multitasking skills than I, but I did have the maturity to understand what I didn't, what I wasn't good at or didn't enjoy. What I really enjoy is the sort of chess game of investing.
Yeah, there's a theory about entrepreneurship. They call it effectual entrepreneurship. I'm not sure why, but it starts by asking the question, who am I? What do I know? And what am I good at? And who do I know that I can combine with in my organization? So it sounds like you've done a good job of that self-assessment of who am I?
Yeah, those are critical. I think the true entrepreneurs, most entrepreneurs are decent at identifying needs. The ones who progress are ones who can, first of all, figure out how to meet those needs at a profit. But the ones who really succeed are the ones who can institutionalize the response, that is, building a business around fulfilling needs. And there comes a time, I think, when every entrepreneur needs to recognize what role they play in the organization that meets the needs. And you also, I think, over time, it would be useful at least to have the ability to understand how the needs have shifted and how the response needs to shift.
Yeah, and one part of that, another field that we're always exploring, Rick, is empathy. So to build a business that can make a profit from serving others requires a certain amount of empathy, understanding other people's needs, and needs are subjective and emotional. So how important is that? Do you count empathy as one of your skills?
I do. In fact, I have empathy that's different from many people in the financial services business. My empathy tends to run to my customers. We joke in finance that you're supposed to be able to raise capital for companies efficiently, which is to lower the company's cost of capital at the same time that you're supposed to allocate capital from investors efficiently. Well, I believe that's impossible. So I focus where I believe my bread is buttered. That is, I enjoy assisting people, buyers, that is, in the function. So a lot of my empathy, of course, goes to my customers. On the other hand, I enjoy helping entrepreneurs build their businesses, mining businesses, oil and gas businesses, all forms of extractive businesses. And while the issuer, that is, while the companies that we allocate capital to may engage in fairly arduous negotiations with me leading up to a financing, 7 or 8 seconds after the check cashes, we're partners. So it's important to feel empathy all the way through the value chain.
Yeah, you talked in one of your speeches, I think, about to make the financial transaction work, you've got to trust your counterparty, and that's the first basis of that emotional connection.
That's really true, particularly because I focus on smaller companies where information and context is important. To the extent that I can't trust my sources of information, I don't have any information. And with no information, you can't make decisions. There are some people who have been reasonably successful in the natural resources business who I do not and never will do business with because they have lied to me. And if they lie to me, I can't trust any information that they give me. And the consequence of that is that I can't do business with them, no matter how tempting the proposal.
So that is that an objective assessment of the quality of the information or a subjective assessment of the individual who's the source of the information, or both?
Well, if I've made a subjective assessment of the individual and I find that individual wanting, I take the position that I have no information.
Yeah. Good. That's really good insight, Rick, to help some of our entrepreneurs who might be thinking through that. I want to switch to this the general platform of entrepreneurship, because I think you're a believer in its social significance as well as its individual significance. You said that entrepreneurs help others in order to help themselves, and you've talked about that a little bit up to this point. So I call that the beneficent system of entrepreneurship. It's not a very good word, but it's a benefit for everybody. Tell us how that took hold for you, and we want to talk about why everybody doesn't see the beneficence of that that system.
I guess it was evident to me from the beginning. Really, it was reading Human Action that codified it for me. In other words, I believed it, but I didn't understand it until it was put into words by somebody else. But I certainly understood from a very young age that my calling was to find needs and fill them. If someone has a need and you fill it, by definition, you have benefited them.
Right.
This whole suggestion that a market is something other than an enormous mutual benefit organization is silly. If there is a willing buyer and a willing seller, the buyer surrenders something of value, the product of his or her own generated utility, to purchase utility from somebody else. And to suggest that the vast majority of those transactions aren't entered into with a point of view of a win-win is sort of silly. And my innate understanding was always that if I identified a need and I fulfilled it in a way that satisfied my customers well enough that they were continuing customers, and also compensated me to the extent that I was willing to continue to fulfill that need, that in a very small way, the world had become a better place instantaneously.
Right. And then when that's accumulated through trillions of those transactions, the world's become a very much better place.
Correct. I mean, look at, as an example, the wonderful entrepreneurs out of Silicon Valley, the 5 or 6 pimply-faced kids that commandeer a garage in Sunnyvale, and out comes the technology that you and I are speaking on. It's truly amazing.
The other element, Rick, that is introduced, and we understand its signaling value, but it's sometimes where the non-thinkers trip up, is the profit motive. So I quoted something from you where you wrote that the fact that companies make money is tangible proof that they did good. Their customers gave them compensation for goods and services that the customers valued more than the payments made. So that's the profit element that is vital to keeping that system going. Yet sometimes it's profit where our critics trip up and say profit is exploitative. Where does that come from, do you think?
I have no idea. But the whole concept that profit is a function of utility just seems so obvious to me. When people say that big, successful organizations owe a duty to society, the fact that they're so profitable, unless they're a government and they can compel, you know, through force or threat or fraud or something like that, the fact that they're so profitable is, from my point of view, tangible evidence that they have generated really incredible utility for their customers. In other words, they proof that they have discharged their obligation to society is, in fact, their profitability.
Right. I was reading something the other day where there was an attempt to evaluate free goods like the Google search bar that we don't directly pay for. And the methodology was to ask people how much you would have to pay them for them not to use Google or Facebook or something like that for a month. And those were big numbers. That's a lot of utility that's created without revenue.
It's astonishing. And, you know, maybe the best marketing tool in the world is to give people value before you ask them to pay you for some other service, which is a classic example of what Google has done. Google has generated and generates today, every day, tremendous, tremendous free utility. And the consequence of that is that they sell access to you in exchange for your utilization of their free good. People who don't like Google would be well advised to turn it off.
Mm-hmm. But they don't. They're getting value. So use the phrase, Rick, in this context of money and justice, i.e. combining those two things that the social justice warriors sometimes tell us are separable. And can you expand on that idea? Was that an attempt to create a new trope that we can market, money and justice?
Well, I'm not so sure I conflate money and justice extremely well. I suspect the question might involve whose money it is and who has the choice as to how it is utilized. I mean, if we really, really want to be moral about it, I think we come to recognize that market transactions are voluntary transactions and government transactions are involuntary transactions. And so if we were going to equate money with morality, I guess I would say that government money is bad and private money is good.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, were you, and I've read this data from time to time, were you to poll the vast majority of Americans as to whether they would pay tax if it were voluntary, if the collection of tax wasn't enforced by threat or the force of threat, that they wouldn't pay the tax. If you follow from that, that people's income is a function of a payment for their labor and utility, Then when you look at tax, you're stuck with the fact that it is either extortion or slavery, probably extortion because the government can't sell you. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to equate money with immorality, I think you would be stuck saying that money that's acquired from force or threat or fraud is immoral, but only that.
Right. Yeah, the one of my favorite phrases is Huerta de Soto said that the most just society is the one that best unleashes the creativity of its entrepreneurs. And that's his version of justice. So those of us who, like me and you, understand this this beneficent system of entrepreneurial dynamism, we seem to have a difficulty communicating it to some folks. And you know, I understand that's partially because they get a lot of propaganda in school that they have to overcome. But you give a lot of talks to young people and advice to young people. What have you found is the best way to communicate? What resonates with skeptical young audiences about entrepreneurship and profit?
I have to start by saying that the young people that I deal with are the most receptive generation that I've come across, albeit from a very small base. You know, if you took me back to my university days and introduced the word libertarian, I wouldn't have been able to spell it.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's a student group now called Students for Liberty that has over 160,000 young people in it. I have been active over Skype, mentoring young groups in Eastern Europe and Africa. And I'm extremely optimistic about spreading the word of liberty. So at the beginning, I'm optimistic as opposed to pessimistic. Okay. I have found that the best way of engaging groups of people, young or old, is sort of Socratic dialogue, asking questions and then proceeding down their own line of thought. I was once, I'm not sure if this was a successful effort, but it was amusing. I was once at a Sierra Club meeting where they were talking about natural resources policy. Nobody there knew what I did for a living.
Mm-hmm.
But they asked me for my view. And I said, I think we need to begin early in the discussion. Certainly, I support efforts to preserve and, in fact, enhance the environment. But we need to do it, I think, in a human context. So before we talk about specific policy measures, I think we need to talk about slavery. Does the Sierra Club favor or do they not favor slavery? And then I went into my discussion of tax.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after you go through the yes buts, it was pretty obvious that while what I had to say was unpleasant, that there were five or six people in a group of 30 who came away with a very different perspective on what policy was. The idea that there is a we and that a fairly small number of the we can govern the actions and the disposition of the wealth of many is at least debatable.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found that rather than sort of engaging in libertarian or anarcho-capitalist blather, that my best approach personally is to engage people by beginning to ask them questions about their beliefs and then follow up with subsequent questions that causes them to wonder about any discrepancies or inconsistencies that there might be in their own philosophy.
Yeah, good, as opposed to lecturing them or yelling at them.
You know, the beginning of codifying my own belief was meeting, I guess, in the mid-80s with Doug Casey and Jack Pugsley. And I considered myself to be apolitical at the time. They were discussing politics amongst them, and Doug asked me what my own politics were, and I said I don't have any. The value proposition that interests me is I will leave other people alone, and I would ask that they leave mm-hmm. me alone. And mm-hmm. Doug said, "Well, you're a libertarian, and the only thing I knew about libertarian was Lyndon LaRouche and folks like that."
And
Lyndon LaRouche wanted to murder Jane Fonda and blow up whales and stuff. And, you know, I thought Jane Fonda was kind of cute and I liked whales. And so I said, no, I'm not a libertarian. I'm not one of those guys. And Pugsley didn't argue with me at all. He gave me a copy of Economics in One Lesson. He said, do me a favor. I like you. Read this and then we'll visit.
Yeah.
It was very useful.
Well, good. Who gave you Human Action?
After Economics in One Lesson, I began to be, like many of us, quite interested. So I read the whole sort of panoply, The Road to Serfdom and all that kind of stuff. So I probably gave me Human Action.
Yeah.
But certainly a lot of people asked me to read it.
I just want to loop back one step there. Ricky, you mentioned an exciting word there for us, which is mentoring. And you gave us a fascinating detail too, is saying you can do that over Skype. And mentoring is one of the fields that we want to investigate on our project here. Say a little bit about how that works, when it works well, what are the attributes that make it a successful undertaking?
That's such a broad topic. I don't know if this is permissible, but if you Google Rick Rule and mentoring, you'll see a couple long talks that I've done on it, one for Liberty.me and another for an ongoing seminar series called Capitalism and Morality. But mentoring is something that really interests me, and I've studied it a lot. I think there are certain duties is not the right word. I think there are certain ways that both the mentor and the people being mentored need to approach the whole process. But that's a discussion that probably exceeds the amount of time that you and I have available. It's certainly become my key avocation, although I learn certainly that as somebody who helps other people invest money, that I have inadvertently been a mentor for 35 years.
Well, that's certainly part of it. It's experience sharing, right? But I think I'm referring to what sounds like a little bit more formal implementation of it.
You know, I think at the beginning of the discussion, it needs to be led by the person who's going to be mentored.
Mm-hmm.
Many people look at learning as a circumstance where the person at the dais has all the knowledge and all of the people in the room are receptacles. Well, obviously, arithmetically, that's wrong if there's 30 people in the audience and one person at the dais. But in order to successfully mentor someone, the person that's going to be mentored needs to have a decent understanding of what they hope to achieve and how the person that they are approaching in the process, as specifically as can be identified, can assist them, narrowing the scope of work. So among other things, the mentor can choose to take or not take that job. And I think often in mentoring, both parties get the process backwards. They think that the transaction should be originated by the mentor rather than the mentee. And I've certainly learned in my experience that the mentorships that I don't accept give me the ability to discharge my duties with those that I do accept to a very great degree.
Yeah, so it's a good economic transaction, right? You're aligning the interests of the mentor and the mentee, if mentee is the right expression.
Correct. But for me, it's a consumer good. I don't get paid.
Well, good. Well, I tell you what, I'll make you a deal. I'll study those two addresses or speeches that you gave on mentoring. And if you got any more, send them along. And then maybe we'll get together again and talk about mentoring. We want to see if we can institutionalize some for our Economics for Entrepreneurs community, you know, build a site, do it electronically, which it sounds like you've done through using Skype as a medium. So we'd like to learn from you and see if we can build something.
Well, hopefully there's something to learn. It's certainly the outgrowth of hundreds, perhaps thousands of hours of effort over time.
Well, that's always creating new knowledge, right, by definition. So we will try to absorb it.
And as you embark on that, you know, I've been able to have these mentorship discussions with young people in Belarus, in Russia, in the United Arab Emirates, in Uganda, Rwanda, Nigeria. It is really, really, really fun to do.
Yeah, and we look at entrepreneurship as something that is a global undertaking. We want to improve people's lives everywhere, so there's no reason why not. And there's such a lot of burgeoning liberty-oriented groups in, as you say, Eastern Europe and Brazil and a lot of other places that I've been in contact with too. So that's very exciting. So I will do that, Rick. I'll do my studying and we'll ask to have you back to talk about mentoring. But thank you very much for today. You've been very inspiring. We've learned a lot. I'm going to see if I can edit some of the key elements that you've talked about. We create a section we call Key Takeaways on our website to help people. So we'll try and do that. And maybe we'll have some more volunteers to have you be their mentor.
Wonderful. Thank you. I look forward to the process.
Good, Rick. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, sir.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.